Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players, uncover their stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, stick around. You're in the right place. Hi, this is Craig. Just want to let you know you can now advertise here on Everyone Loves Guitar podcast. For more information, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. That's everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. Hey, everybody, this is Craig Garber with Everyone Loves Guitar. And in my continued pursuit to find every great guitar player in New York City, we got another one with Johnny Lamb today. Johnny's a steel player and a guitar player, pedal steel and lap steel. He's a member of Sin Cane, and he's toured all over the world with them. He's also part of the Atomic Bomb Band supergroup, and he leads his own band called Honey Fingers, and he recorded an album with Jim Campolongo, who I interviewed a while ago. Johnny's work with a real diverse array of bands and producers in the studio and on stage. Check these names out: David Byrne, Norah Jones, Billy Joe Armstrong, Emmylou Harris, Busta Rhymes. What a diversity. Emmylou Harris, Busta Rhymes, and Billy Joe Armstrong. When's the last time those three names were mentioned sequentially? Benny Blanco, Keb Moe, Sean Paul, Steve Earle, Pharoah Sanders, the Blind Boys of Alabama, Jamie Liddell, Charles Lloyd, Taj Mahal, again, Jim Campolongo, and Alexis Taylor from Hot Chip, and more. He recently finished a tour last week with Miranda Lambert, where he got to play up at the Ryman in Nashville. He also played with the American Grammy Awards for the Emmylou Harris tribute with Emmylou, Steve Earle, Brandi Carlile, Jennifer Nettles. He finished an Exotica EP, and he is working on new music written the last year on tour, which combines elements of rock, jazz, and Chinese traditional melodies. Dude, you're a... What are you doing in your free time?
You know, I hang out with the dog. Hang out with the girlfriend and the dog.
Good for you, man. What's happening today?
Nothing. Just went for a walk and did the morning walk with the puppy. And then, this.
Well, thanks for coming on the show, Johnny. You play pedal and lap steel and also electric. How'd you get into playing pedal and, you know, steel guitar? That is not very common, especially in New York City. And Luca Benedetti told me, you're not just a good steel player. He said, you're like amazing. So like when Luca Benedetti says that, that's a pretty impressive, you know, credibility thing there, man. So how did you get involved in pedal and lap steel?
Well, first I'd like to say thanks to Luca for the exaggeration. But, every guitar player moves to New York and they're like trying to be involved in the micro economy of singer-songwriters. And I guess at some point I started playing in like alt country bands, and I was like, oh, like I think I can play pedal steel, and then I'll become like, you know, one of a handful of pedal steel players in New York. And I picked it up, and it was a lot harder I thought it would be. I thought because I could play like that cliche pedal steel lick on guitar that it would be an easy transition, but it is not, you know.
How long have you been playing pedal steel?
I feel like it's always been just 3 years, but I think it's been 3 years for probably almost 10 years.
Good for you, man. So that's just smart though. You wanted to create literally a business differential for yourself, which I think is super smart, you know, and obviously you've done it. Worked it hard enough that it's yours now.
Well, I think that now I'm glad that I play steel and I really enjoy it in it. When I first started playing, I really felt a good kinship to the instrument. Like the E9 pedal steel, the country neck, kind of has all of the information built in stylistically. So in a way, for a musician like many of us are, with all so much pedagogy and like all the books and all the videos, you can learn a lot of different styles. You don't necessarily develop your own personal sound or, you know, focus on that, because everyone just feels like you're trying to sink or swim, you know, you're trying to stay above water, like how trying to be really good and trying to like take a good solo and like learn all your modes. And those are totally important things. But when I started playing steel, you kind of get trapped into this box, and it, in a way, it's very difficult to break out. But because your bass is a lot, the bass level of like what E9 pedal steel sounds like is really common, and everyone knows it. Like everyone knows the 1 to 4 chord move. So stylistically, you kind of get a little bit of a break, because as you panic to learn the instrument, you still have like a pretty high bass level of satisfaction, you know. But if I just gave a kid a guitar and I was like, hey, here's the pentatonic scale, here's the blues scale, then what happens? They don't sound like B.B. King, you know? They might not even remotely sound like B.B. King, even if they're playing the same notes. They probably won't, you know? B.B. King is, there's a lot of other things in music. But in pedal steel, you do that move, and everyone knows that move. You know, that's like a 20th century, that's like an iconic thing, that 1 chord to 4 chord, you know, the Webb Pierce slowly move, you know? So I think that steel guitar was really important for me in terms of beginning to focus on developing my own personal identity and kind of relieving my brain of like, I'm not Wes Montgomery, I'm not Jimi Hendrix, I'm not all these people, you know?
That's really cool. So you started this new journey, and I think that's so cool when you go down a road that you're looking for one thing and something else really cool comes out of it that gives you, that was never in your mind, you know. It's like very rewarding when that happens,
right?
Yeah, really cool, man. How come?
So just right into it, right into like the a really long response.
No, it was good, man. It was very cool. What is the, like, when I left New York in 89, and I've been back almost every year since, just to hang, but like, what is this? Where did the alt country, because there's like bars and tons of guys playing, or, and you know, guys, people, players playing alt country. And like, I don't think you'd probably get shot if you even played country, you know, when I left New York City. It was not the, you know, what the scene is now. Where did that evolve from, or how do you think it evolved?
You know, like they've been talking about like the country, alt country scene in New York for a long time. I get, you know, long time relative, like,
yeah,
you know, Ryan Adams, like Jayhawks, like that kind of thing. And there was a movement about like this Brooklyn country scene, maybe I think 10 or 15 years ago, you know. But it was like, I guess now I feel like people are delving more into like the later classic country instead of like the 40s and 50s. People are more focused on like the country rock, like 60s and 70s, and like, you know, like the outlaw country has become more of a thing in culture as well as the scene in New York. And I'm sure as you've talked to many of the players in New York, there's a bar in town that has live music 7 days a week, and like the rodeo bar used to do, it's pretty well curated with like all these kind of country groups that are playing the music of like Emmylou Harris, or, you know, and, you know, like Paycheck and all that, George Jones and all that kind of stuff. And those are like their role models rather than, you know, playing Hank Williams tunes, which is great also, but rhythmically different. There's more of like a, I think there's more young people starting to do that, I guess. And totally, that would be why there's such like a evolution. And culturally, there's like a whole country music scene that's like more of a throwback rather than pop country.
What bar is it, are you talking about?
Oh, that bar is called Skinny Dennis.
That's in Brooklyn.
That's in Brooklyn, in Williamsburg, Brooklyn.
Yeah, yeah. And it's, the whole scene is mostly in Brooklyn, because like in the city, it's still the jazz thing.
I mean, I think they have that Opry city stage. You know, they're trying to do stuff, and there's a lot of bars that have live music, and country bands are part of that.
Oh, are they? Okay.
But, yeah.
No, that's awesome.
You know, the old Banjo Jim's is a venue called, you know, a bar called the Wayland now, and they have music sometimes. And yeah, there's bars that do it. Hill Country still has country music, you know, 7 days a week, I think. And
Hill Country, I thought that was like a, isn't that a ribs place?
It's like a corporate barbecue place.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Yeah. I think I actually went there like five years ago. Did you really? Well, dude, I'm coming back to the city like in the end of October. I'm going to look you guys up. I'd love to see one of you all playing. Every time I come, no one's playing anyway. It's like the weekend's shut down or something.
Jim Campolongo is always playing. He's a legend. He has so much energy for music. It's so crazy.
He's awesome.
It's so difficult to do what he has done and, you know, to play that regular gig for however many years. And it takes like a lot of effort and it takes a lot of energy. And it's really impressive that he just keeps doing it, you know?
Well, he's extremely organized and he has a lot. And he does the lessons thing online. I mean, he's extreme. Let me tell you my first encounter with Jim. I think maybe a second time we communicated, I get an email at 4:30 in the morning.
Cause like, he had just gotten up. That's when he gets up.
Right. And then when I'm talking on the phone, I'm like, you know, Jim, I spoke to you. You don't seem like the guy that was like going to bed at 4:30 in the morning. So like, what's the deal? He goes, oh no, I get up 4:30 every day. And this way I could have my 3 hours of practice and get all my stuff done. But that's why he sounds like Jim Campolongo, you know, but he is so disciplined, that guy. I mean, he's just a master. Talk about Sin Cane, because you guys are incredibly popular. You make very melodic music and you have a rabid following. And I was curious, how did you hook up with the band? And if you could just give a background to the band and the kind of music you play and where you've toured for people that may not know you guys.
Sin Cane is the brainchild of Ahmed Jalab, who's a Sudanese American. He's an amazing musician. He played in like hardcore bands, legendary hardcore bands from Kent, Ohio and Columbus, Ohio. And he got his first break was with Caribou and ended up playing with Of Montreal and Yesayer all at their peaks, you know. And finally he started to pursue his own project and it kind of has morphed from like a krautrocky spiritual jazz self-made records by himself, which is insane. He's an insane person. And then he started to incorporate a band and, you know, it was a quartet for a while and with a different guitar player and I ended up joining. We had some mutual friends and we had played together with a great singer-songwriter, Cooper Formant. And that's how we initially met. And then fast forward like maybe a year and a half later, he's like, hey, do you want to like get together and jam? And I was like, I know, you know, I was like deep in like full on like New York. This is the first time in my life that I had been like playing nonstop. And I had my own band, that Honey Fingers, and we were playing like 4 nights a week, like 12 hours on the bandstand. It was a really insane time for me. And he's like, do you want to like jam? And I was like, okay, you know, who is this guy? I know what jamming means. You're trying to like get an audition, you know?
Right.
So we get together, get to play with Ahmed and the drummer for Sin Cane until recently, Jason Trammell, J Tram. And we just like vibed and had a good time. And Ahmed said to me, hey, like, we're doing this thing. And Ahmed and I had hung out a couple times before that and he disappeared on tour for a year, which is why that happened. And we had a great time. We bonded over Buffalo Wings and, you know, he loves country music and he's like, hey, I'm like, we're going to go to Australia in like 2 months. Do you want to go? And I was like, yeah. You know? I was like, okay. You know, and he's like, and then we're going to like do this thing, this project with David Byrne. Do you want to do that? And I was like, yeah, okay.
Twist my arm.
Yeah. And then he's like, how do you feel about touring? And I was like, I don't know. I don't really want to go on tour. I kind of got this thing in New York happening and I feel good about it. And then like fast forward, like, you know, 5 years later and Australia, New Zealand, Africa, Europe many, many, many times, the whole states, like, you know, more than, you know, 130 gigs a year.
It's awesome.
You know, man. Like, and here we are, you know.
That's great, man. I'm happy for you. What is your role with the band? You do steel and electric, or?
I mainly play electric guitar, yes. and I'll play pedal steel for some tunes. There's a couple tunes that have a steel guitar feature, and on the last record, there is actually a lot of pedal steel on it, but it's all affected and in the background, so you kind of just get the lift of pedal steel slightly, but not as literal as on the record before, Mean Love, where there were two songs where it was like very literally country music influenced, and there's like straight up pedal steel.
Cool, man. Do you contribute on the writing end as well?
Yeah, I help out with arrangements, and Ahmed is generous with how he feels like we contribute, and so, you know, it's mostly like in arrangements, and it's been at first Ahmed comes in with like these things almost fully realized. It's pretty incredible, you know, like they could be a record, but he has allowed people more and more into his process, which is hard because as an artist you want to create the thing that's in your mind, and he has the capability to do that, and it's incredible. So as he's come further along in the project, he's been able to release himself with the literal translations of what he has in his mind. And he's able to say, I want Johnny to contribute, or I want Elena, the keyboard player in Sinkin, to contribute. And he'll just do a sketch and he'll say, well, you know, something like that. But a lot of times the thing that he puts down is kind of the thing, you know, because it's like this vision. And so removing myself and my ego from like, oh, I need to, like, I'm the guitar player, I have to contribute with the guitar part. He's allowed all of us to contribute in a more holistic way, which I believe is a lot healthier. You know, as a sideman in New York, we are beholden to how good we are. But what does that even mean, especially as a guitar player? Because it's like, well, everyone can – a lot – so many good guitar players, but what does that even mean? Because a guy who's technically so good will fit in one project but maybe to be too technical for another project. So it's always like which guitar player, specifically guitar, fits the vibe, you know? So if you fit the vibe, you can – or like accept that like the vibe is more important than yourself, and you say, okay, I don't have to be judged on like a guitar solo. That doesn't like – mean anything in terms of how I contribute to music, you know. It could, but for that to be the thing that is your validation is a dangerous and scary thing, because musically what does it mean, you know? It may mean nothing to a lot of music, but it may mean everything to music. But I think that a balance between the two of like, oh, how do I contribute to the song? What does this song mean? And a solo can contribute to that rather than like, I need to play a perfect guitar solo. You know, does my guitar, or like, it's just another part in music.
So how long did it take you playing as a professional till you got to the point where you sort of realized that where, you know, it's a tough thing because you spend all these years alone in a room with your guitar doing that thing. And then you're basically saying, hey, I realize that doesn't validate me, you know, and you're right. It doesn't, but how long did it take you to get to that point or just to realize it, I guess?
I mean, it's taken my whole life until pretty recently, you know, like I just finished an Exotica record this year, and this record came about because I had written some music and I had tried to force it into what I believed was the sound of Honey Fingers, which I no longer have what is that word? Like, I don't feel like Honey Fingers is in a box. It's just a thing that happens and I'm involved and, you know, I just make music, whatever. I guess it would be like steel guitar centric. So I like tried to make like a Western swing, you know, like a Texas swing kind of band music. And I had written some tunes, and I was going to go work at go to record this at a friend's studio, Restoration Sound in Williamsburg. And he had like an Ampex mono tape machine. And he's like, oh, you got to come and just like cut something mono live. And I was like, hell yeah, you know? So I went in and I cut it. And it was pretty disorganized because like rehearsals in New York are hard to come by. And I trust my band, you know? And so I brought the music in and we did it. And I listened back and I was like, holy shit, this is fucking horrible. It caused me so much anxiety. Not like that anyone's playing was horrible. It was just like this disorganized mess, and it was amplified by the fact that it was a mono mix, you know. And I was really, really, really taken aback. It was like a huge blow, you know. I just was like, wow, this is not good. And I had never really, you know, I produced like some tracks and then some music, and I produced a bunch of Funny Fingers tracks with like all these guest singers, you know, that I'm still working on. And it was really great. And it was this awesome experience. And then I went in to do this, and instrumental music can be a little bit more challenging. So when I listened, I was like, these songs, it doesn't feel right. Nothing felt right. So I like revisited, I started to get into huge edits, and I realized that like I had been trying to jam these songs into feels that they maybe were not the right feel. So I started to let the music tell me what it wanted. And then it ended up with like Bolero and like, you know, all these kind of feels that are not really like swing feels. And then another step further, as I kept writing, I was like, oh, I don't like, these songs don't have to be about steel guitar. They don't have to be about me. They just are about creating this vibe, you know. Not all, and I'm not saying that all music is like that, because there's some music that's like, you know, guitar trio records or jazz quartets. Like that's about those people, you know. Sure. And I don't mean that in any sort of pejorative way. Like that's amazing. But this music that I had written was not about it, and I didn't have to make this record about me. So I did arrangements, and I, you know, it's like six songs and a vocal track, a song with the vocal, with a guest vocalist, where I did like one version with steel guitar melody. And it's like, and then one where we did the track and slightly edited. And I had a great singer, Nick Hakim, sing on it. And there was like some tunes I don't even play on, you know? And it's like my record. But I was like, well, I don't need to play on this. Like, this sounds like a small group. You know, there's horns on here. Like, I don't have to jam steel guitar on here. And it really freed me up, you know?
I was going to ask you that. Once you kind of realized that, I bet you took a lot of pressure off you.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, yeah.
You know, and there's steel guitar moments for sure. There's a Hawaiian tune that I wrote many years ago that I finally got recorded, and you know, and I do like a version of Skylark where I sing using like the pedal steel.
That old song, Skylark?
Yeah, the Hoagy Carmichael tune.
That's a pretty song, man.
It's one of my favorite songs. And I did, you know, and I played pedal steel on it, but I did it like a modern version of Pete Drake or something like that.
Great. That's cool, man. And it's what album? And that's the Exotica record.
That's like I like to call it, it's going to be two EPs. I like to call it Honey Fingers, The Lost Tapes.
Because that's perfect,
actually,
man.
We haven't actually released anything, and I have like, you know, I'm sitting on like a gold mine of stuff that I just can't get that last 10%.
That's great, man. Well, just let me know and I'll post it up, because I'd like to check it out myself, man. So you've worked with some cool people. Let me throw some names out there, and maybe for each of these artists, if you could talk about how you got the gig and maybe a cool or interesting or funny story about working with them. And let's start with David Byrne from the Heads.
Well, like I said, it was with Sin Cane. And so Sin Cane was the core band of the Atomic Bomb supergroup. And we played Ahmed, who is Sin Cane. He was asked to be the musical director of that project. And the core band was Money Mark on keyboards, Sin Cane, which was Ahmed, Mike Ish Montgomery on bass, and Jason J. Tram Trammell on drums. And we had Pat Mahoney from LCD Sound System, who also played drums, so double drums. And we had this amazing talking drum player from New York, Kofo. the Wonder Man.
What do you mean talking drums, like beatbox?
No, like a African Nigerian drum that has a head and it's tied on with ropes, and you can change pitch by tightening your grip on the ropes that are around the drum.
And it's called a talking drum.
Because they can make it sing. They can play pitches.
Okay, cool.
It's incredible. So that's he cool. can sing on it. Like, it's pretty amazing. And then we had varying background singers, you know, but we would play the music of this amazing Nigerian recluse from this late 70s, who William Onyebor, and he made this collection of records, you know, ultimately to make money because he was a businessman, but he somehow managed to create this like unique, incredible, joyous music, you know, music that we spent 3 months in rehearsal.
Wow.
There was no way that I was getting on stage with David Byrne, and there were so many guests, you know, David Byrne, and we got to play with Joshua Redman and Charles Lloyd and Pharoah Sanders and M1, Jamie Liddell, Alexis Taylor from Hot Chip, Damon Albarn from Gorillaz and Blur, you know, and Dev Hynes. There's no way that I would go into a situation like that, and all those singers needed to lean on us, and
yeah.
I didn't want us to not be a rock. So we spent a month of rehearsals as quartet. Then we spent another month of rehearsals with the second drummer and 2 weeks with Money Mark. And that was the main band. Just getting these arrangements are very strange and eclectic.
Mm.
And so then we went into rehearsals with the guest singers for the first run of shows. And, you know, we did like 40 hours of rehearsal in a week in London, and then played, you know, two sold out shows at the Barbican, and went to Bristol and played another sold out show, and came to the US and did two shows at BAM sold out, and the Warfield in San Francisco sold out.
Very cool.
The Greek. It was like an incredible experience. We got to play with the Lejadu sisters. I don't know if you know anything about them.
No, no. What about them?
They're these identical twins from Nigeria as well. And they wrote amazing music. They had a relationship with Ginger Baker. I think they were in the documentary.
Wait a minute. The two twins had a relationship with Ginger Baker?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's like a Ginger Baker thing.
Oh, identical twins?
No. I mean, just like doesn't surprise me, like that the guy had a relationship with twins. Like, you know, most normal people, like, I can't manage my one relationship, you know, and he's got two twins. That's hysterical, man.
And so they ended up having to leave Nigeria because their music is very political. They have very strong beliefs, and they had to escape. And they have asylum in New York City, and they're incredible. They're very sweet, and it's hard. They haven't had to see their family in many, many, many years. They're not a lot. They can't go back, you know. So I can't imagine what they're going.
David get involved? Like, what was his role in this? Was he the guy spearheading it?
David was one of the original owners of Luwaka Bop, and they were going to re-release all these records, you know, like a 7 LP box set. Because I think these records go for like thousands of dollars, you know, like on the market, and they're hard to get. And so Luwaka Bop was re-releasing them, and they wanted to put a band together to celebrate this. And
gotcha.
So we had this initial run, and it went very well. And so then we just kind of kept doing it. And for the next couple years, probably for 3 years, I think the last one we played was about a year ago in Italy. But before that, maybe 18 months, you know. So it's wound down now. But so David was involved, and David, you know, wanted to be one of the performers, and it was amazing working with him. His whole existence of how he uses, how he's an artist. And I think he's an amazing role model, especially in typical New York fashion, where he's the role model for using every resource that he has to help assist him create more art, writing books and doing theater shows and musicals and making records and making art and always being focused on that. And his whole company is there in support to help him do that. And that's like an incredible, incredible thing, you know.
Man, he was so ever present as a kid growing up in New York City. You know, the Heads were such a big presence.
Thank God, yeah.
In the late 70s, and the whole, you know, they really took, I guess, what would the word be back then? Indie music? I don't know what they called it back then, but he, you know, the Heads were at the forefront of all of that stuff, and, you know, him. And I actually, I was really excited because I think I'm getting Jerry Harrison on the show. So I was like, I found it this week. So I was like, really stoked because, you know, that's just awesome. I want to just talk to the guy. I just want to shut up and let him tell stories for like an hour. Just, you know, because those guys have done so much musically. Busta Rhymes. What did you do with Busta? How'd you get involved? And any funny stories?
No funny stories. I got to play with I got to meet this incredible singer, Jamie Liddell, through the Atomic Bomb Project. That project really introduced me to a lot of different kinds of music and a lot of different kinds of people. And Jamie is this incredible, incredible singer. I know this is about Busta Rhymes, and I'll get there, but Busta Rhymes is an afternote to Jamie Liddell, who is like, I can't, you know, when like the drummers have someone like sing drum parts to them, and most drummers I know are like, I fucking hate that. it's like the worst. Okay. So I ended up doing a couple shows with Jamie, and I went down for rehearsal, and I was going to play mostly guitar and then play a little bit of pedal steel on like a ballad or something. And he is just like, can you do like this? And he would sing a lick, and a long one, you know, because his references were like a Funkadelic, you know. And because there's a little bit of pedal steel in some of those Funkadelic records.
Is there? And,
yeah.
I had no idea. I would have never thought that.
Yeah. And so he's like, can you do like this? And he would sing like a 2-bar phrase. And I would listen, and I'd be like, what the fuck? He's like singing me actual pedal steel licks, you know? He's incredible. He like is amazing. I can't speak highly enough of him. He is just like, and he's like become a great friend, and I think he's amazing.
That's,
you know,
cool, man.
But I got to play this show with him, and one of his other friends, Alex Billowitz, was an amazing keyboard player, lives in New York, and was on the gig, and we connected. And one day he just was like, hey, are you like free tomorrow at like 11 p.m.? And I was like, yeah, all right.
11 p.m.
And I was like, yeah, sure. And he goes, okay, cool. Let me just confirm. Let me see what time Busta is going to be in the studio. And I was like, what? I didn't ask any questions. I'm always just like, yeah, whatever you need, I'll show up.
That's such a great, you know what? I've talked to so many people, and like, that is the standard way that great things happen to players. It's like they just want to play guitar or whatever it is they're doing, and they want to show up, and they got another gig. Great. You know, and it's with someone you like, is a good vibe. Great. And then you go there and it's fucking like wild shit, like Busta Rhymes or something.
I mean, that's how the Nora, it's similar to how the Nora Jones, Billy Joe Armstrong connection happened, you know? So just to finish the Busta Rhymes things, he just was like, I roll to the studio in Midtown next to the M&M store.
And oh, this is like right in Midtown, like Times Square.
It's fully Midtown. I mean, like all those great studios were in Midtown, you know? Mm. It had like this beautiful wood igloo room that kind of, I think the same architect ended up building or working on the Bunker studio in Brooklyn, which is a great studio. So I roll in, there's no guitar. I had to bring a guitar amp, you know, there's just a piano in the room, and I set up the amp, and I go into the control room, and Alex is like, you know, like Busta usually comes in a little bit later. Let's just get started. And we started working on the track, and at some point, you know,
comes in later than 11. because 11 is too early to be recording.
So then Alex is like, hold on, here's Busta. He's calling me. And then he's like, yo, what? He's like, hey, Busta, what's going on? It's Alex. I'm here with my friend Johnny. And I said, I'll never forget it. I said, what up, Busta? And I, in my brain, I immediately went, wow, I never thought I would ever say that. Yeah. And he was like, cool, you guys got the track, whatever. So I spent like maybe 45 minutes working on this track with Alex, and Busta comes, and he comes in within 2 seconds of the track playing. He goes, what the fuck? This is too fast. You did it the wrong fucking sample rate. Not at like us, but he started to get into the engineer a bit, which he should, it's like the engineer's only job. Like he didn't do his job. And so Busta just lit him up. And Alex was like, that was mild,
Wow.
We're all professional. Like we should be hold to high standards of just like doing our jobs. Like that dude is working a fucking session with Busta Rhymes, like do the right fucking sample rate.
Dude, I get it. It's like watching guys in the NFL, they're fucking receivers and like they never catch the ball. It's like, wait a minute. Did you have one job? I totally get it. I'm all about like being accountable. So that's cool.
So then we had to do it again slower, which was fine. And then, working with Busta was pretty, and watching him work and be like the what vibe he wanted is like, he mostly while I was tracking, he sat in the other room on the phone with Easy Mo B. And then when we finished, it just was, he came in and he just sat there and he moved all the little guitar parts and to exactly how he wanted them. And that was like incredible to watch him work, it was a great experience, and I have like a great picture with him where it looks like I'm not sure how this pose happened, but it's like him and I next to each other and his hands are huge and we're like clasping hands, but it just looks like we're going to prom. I'm going to prom with
if you send me that photo, I will use it for this interview.
Oh, it's incredible.
I'm going to make a note here. That sounds awesome. That sounds very classic. That's cool, man. So this was a one track that you guys did with him?
It was just like, Busta needed, everyone is redoing samples. So I think, I just like redid some guitar stuff on a sample.
Yeah.
So it's easier for them to get clearance, I guess.
Very cool, man.
Yeah.
What time did that session end?
It wasn't very long, maybe like 1 o'clock in the morning or something like that.
That's not bad.
Which is very late for me, but.
Oh, it's late, but 2 hours with Buster, that's probably not bad at all.
Yeah, it was all right. It was a good time.
Then you Ubered back to Brooklyn?
Well, I think it was like a weeknight, and in Midtown, on the weeknight late, you can find street parking everywhere because all the street regulations is up.
Oh, really?
I had to bring an amp, so I had to drive. So I was just planning on like, I'll just park in a lot. But then I was like, oh, there's like street parking everywhere.
That's great.
So I just pulled in the street. For all these people listening that don't live in New York City, Midtown is the ground zero for a million people. And it's basically impossible to find parking on the street. But apparently at nighttime, it's all right. So. Damn.
This is so funny. So we're coming up to the city in like I said, end of October, and I was just looking at the parking rates for the hotel.
Holy shit. That's insane.
It was something like $600 if you own a parking for 4 days. I was gonna believe you'd rent a fucking Airbnb for a week probably with that. I mean,
dude, you just gotta like drop everyone off in the city and then like go drive into Brooklyn and park it on the street and then just like move it every 2 days and then
It's crazy. Well, even like when I lived in the Bronx, it was like a pain in the ass because I'm sure they still have every other day,
the street cleaning.
God, that was such a pain in the ass, man. And you'd like, if you had a day off, you're up, your ass is up at 7 to move that vehicle.
Well, the thing about certain, neighborhoods that are residential, like in the Bronx, is that after 6 p.m., I'm sorry, you're not finding a parking spot.
No.
Because everyone's in for the night, So, but there are neighborhoods that are a lot of in transit people. So, where it's easy to find parking at all hours, but Midtown Manhattan is not one of them.
Oh, hell yeah. That's great that you got a spot, man. I don't know why I asked you that. I just thought I was just curious about that.
Oh, man. When anytime there's something in Midtown, it's like a huge alarm.
It's a headache.
Yeah.
How about Billy Joe Armstrong?
Like I was saying in with, you know, how I ended up working with Busta because I was working with Jamie. I had been playing with Jason Laughlin, who you did, I think.
Yeah, his interview comes out tomorrow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great guitar player, great musician. Luca and I had been playing in his Western swing band, the String Gliders.
Yeah.
And started to play with this bass player, Tim Lunsell, who passed away last year.
Sorry about that.
Amazing, incredible musician. He played in Campy's Trio, the original incarnation of the trio in New York, that played at the old knitting, the tap room at the Knitting Factory. You can still like smoke there. It was this weird concrete box. Yeah, this was, I remember going to shows there. There was like a weird little smoking room. And
that is weird.
So I started playing with Tim a lot, and, we became very close. And one day I was outside of Fleischer's Meats on Fifth Avenue in Park Slope, and I got a phone call from Tim, and I was like, hell yeah. So I answered and I was like, what's up? And the other voice said, hi, Johnny, this is Nora. I just wanted to see if you're around on Friday. And it was like Wednesday. And I was like, yeah, okay. I was like, yeah, whatever you want, this was like a amazing, I'll never forget this moment. And it's like a, Tim was such a connector. It's like indicative of like what a wonderful person he was. And I know that moment in the studio, Nora was like, maybe, we can get some pedal steel on some of these tracks. And Tim was like, I got the guy for you. And he had been kind of hinting at this a little bit. He like made sure he had my phone number a couple days before. And then I know that moment happened, and he said, I got the perfect person, and dialed it and handed it to Nora.
That's so cool.
And I never talked to him about that other than like thanking him profusely. And, now that he's gone, it's like a huge honor that I got to be on a record that's like just him, Dan Reeser, who's an amazing drummer, Charlie Burnham, who's an amazing musician, amazing violin player and mandolin singer. Like, he is like a fucking New York legend, and he's a legend. And Nora and Billy Joe. And that's like a pretty crazy thing. It's like six people on a record. It's pretty awesome and special.
Yeah.
So that's how I ended up getting that. And I went over there. I didn't really know what was happening. And so I just kind of went there, and Nora was there. She was very nice. And then, up from the downstairs of the magic shop, Billy Joe comes, and I was like, oh, weird. All right.
Yeah.
I ask a lot of questions, but, sometimes I just don't ask.
Like, any questions. Yeah, well, you can't really say, what are you doing here?
Yeah. But also afterwards, I don't forget if it was after or during, Billy had like left to go work on something downstairs, and I was just like looking at the guitar rack, and I just like pick up a Tele and I'm noodling on it. And I'm like, oh, pretty cool. And I pick up like this Les Paul special double cut. And then the guy looks at me and he goes, pretty cool, right? And I was like, what do you mean? And he goes, like, that's like a 52 Esquire. And that's like a 56 special. And these things look fucking perfect.
That's
and I was
amazing,
like, oh,
man.
Cool. They looked like they were like American standards. They were so shiny and beautiful, And I was like, oh, cool. And then I'll just like put $20,000, $50,000 worth of guitar back.
Yeah, gently.
I'm like standing and playing them too. I mean, no one stands and plays guitar and then like fucking drops it, but I was like, I'll just like put those away.
That's cool, man. I think I've interviewed every guitar player Nora Jones. She's had like 40 guitar players. I've had so many guys that have played with Nora. It's really funny.
She's been with her current band for a couple of years.
Yeah. I know I had Adam Levy played with her and Campolongo, loads of people, man.
Amazing.
What are you working on now that you're excited about?
Well, I finished that Exotica record, which was, it's like maybe 22 minutes of music, but 20, I guess it would be 26 because I did the one song twice. And there's like 24.
What was the deal with that? You did one song twice.
Well, I did one song as an instrumental with the steel playing the melody. And then I did that.
Right. Okay.
I took that track and I broke it down and then I had a friend sing on it. So it's basically the same track with just different melody.
That's kind of, that's actually pretty cool.
Well, you know, I just thought doing this project and playing all these melodies on steel, it just was like a fun thing. And I thought it would just like a good fit for Nick to sing this song.
You know, I can't tell you how much I have been inspired by comments like that over the last, you know, 14, 15 months that I've been doing this by, you know, musicians are some of the only people that do that. Like, I thought it would be fun. And so, and, you know, it really got me thinking, like, why don't I do that? Like, you know, why doesn't everybody do that? Because it seems like, fuck, man, you get one trip here. You get one spin around this earth, right? Like, why shouldn't that be a very significant portion of a decision-making factor in the things you do? And I've been really inspired by that because I've heard that so many times and it's really rubbed off on me. So I think that's great that you did that.
As musicians, especially in New York, we're an impoverished crew. And at the end of the day, what do you have? You have the things that you care about and that you cared about, mm-hmm. and the things that you did your very best to be yourself, you know. And that's how you hopefully have contributed to music.
Yeah.
You know, there's almost no hope to find work. And like, what are you going? And this is a realization I ended up with this year. And what do I, if I can't contribute in a way that I can't be myself and I can't be the best person that I can be, it's not good for the music and it's not good for me.
Yeah. Most important. It's not good for you.
So if I can just keep doing things that are like, well, that'll be fun, I'll just go for that, you know? And that doesn't mean to not be responsible or not to honor the music that you're playing. This is another thing that's I learned from Syncane, which is a similar thing from pedal steel, is that in Syncane, I play so many of the main riffs in unison with the bass, and I'm beholden to that. And as like a guy who played in like at points a lot of pretty loose bands where you're like, just do whatever, just do your thing, you know, my brain refused to organize in a way or like build it. It was so hard to see the music holistically when it's just like you're connecting chord to chord and you're working on a level of from bar to bar. But then when you start working in a music where you have to get to the chorus, you know, it's not like just getting to the four chord. You have to play the part that gets you to the chorus. And so by playing in Syncane and being so restricted, inevitably, because I kind of have got a lot of personality, shit squeaks out. And the shit that squeaks out is the stuff that you're feeling or you're hearing. And as we just kept doing this in Syncane, and I honestly didn't really love this music when I first started playing it. I just was doing it. And I loved Ahmed and I loved Ish and I loved J-Tram. And like being around those guys was amazing. And making music with them and experiencing all these things was so incredible. And there's not a time I play that music that it's not more fun and better than the last time I played that music. And this is like something that's important to me because I can be myself while also honoring Ahmed's vision. Mm. And the more you do it, the more you cultivate and develop your own personal sound. You know, it's like, but Ahmed gave me the framework to be able to start doing that. But if I'm playing in this, and this path is not for everyone, this has just happened for me. If I play in a million bands, kind of lose myself to the music rather than find myself in that music. But by playing the same songs for many years and working on that I really have found myself, you know, I feel.
That's great.
Does that answer that question? Sometimes I get on these tangents.
This is fine. This is like the tangent show, so it's all good. It doesn't matter. You answered it because you were being sincere. Yes, you answered it. You know, it's all like, you know, what more can we – the question is less important than your reaction to the question, sort of.
Yeah, but if there was a question, I think – I'm pretty sure that related to the question, but I can't remember anymore.
There's no right or wrong. It's not like the question was, you know, what is 3 plus 3, you know?
Yeah, but if someone is listening to this and the question is like, what's 1 plus 1? And I'm like, well, 1 plus 1, let me tell you. And I love apples.
It's okay, man. Everybody's a musician listening to this, so they dig it. It's all good. Now I lost my train of thought, which is really bad. I think it's so cool though that you are not doing, like, I'm going to say, quote, conventional stuff, and you're a really busy guy, and to have found all these things that you like, whether you liked them day one or whether you learned something from them, grew as a person, as a musician, and then started liking it and getting a value out of it and giving. I think it's great because you are so busy and you got so many projects going on, man. So,
This year, in terms of like prioritizing projects, this year has been like eye opening and pretty incredible for me. I finished that Exotica record, I probably have 30 plus tracks that are like 90% complete that I just fucking don't know how to finish. And that was why I wanted to do this Exotica record and why I wanted to include. I mean, there's 5 guitar players on this record. It's like Luca is playing, Jason Laughlin's playing, this amazing jazz guitar player, Nate Radley, is playing, Rich Hinman plays on it. I wanted to like include as many people that was important to me, you know, to not make it an insular process. There was a moment this year where someone asked me to play pedal steel for them, and they like really, they were very excited apparently. And they were like, oh man, I would really love for you to play pedal steel with me. I'm coming to New York, do some shows. And I was like, okay, cool. You know, hit me up. So they hit me up and we have a conversation about pay, and I understand that it's very difficult for people to come up with money, and we agree on something, and then he kind of disappears. And then 2 days later, he's like, I'm sorry, I'm glad you can do it, but I found someone in town who can do it for free, and we can rehearse at his house. And I was like, and I was like, okay, that's fine, you know. And then
that's amazing.
The day of the show, I get an email that says, "Hey, it didn't work out with that guy."
Shocking,
because of course it didn't. Can you still do it? And I had a moment where I was like, "Well, what did you want? Did you just want a guy to fill a warm seat, or do you want me?" You know, because I believe I can contribute in my own special way. As musicians, we all should feel that way. And I was like, I never wanted to feel like an afterthought, you know, because as sidemen, we are in service to the songwriter. And I really try to believe very strongly in that. And I haven't always been as respectful. And so, but that respect is a two-way street.
Absolutely, man.
And so I ended up turning the gig down. And then I kind of went into a deep thoughts of like, well, what am I doing? I really didn't like that feeling. And it wasn't about like my ego. It just was like, we get paid so little to do this. I just wanted to do things that I believe in and I think are fun. Back to the fun thing. That was what that conversation was about. And so I was like, what am I waiting for in New York? What am I doing? And I mostly am playing in bands that I love with great friends of mine and having a really good time. You know, I play in the String Gliders. You know, Jason's band has like afforded me to like forge my own like personal strange Western swing steel guitar Jerry Bird identity, which I love. That's like the mentally something. I love playing lap steel. It's an incredible, incredible challenge. And the almost exact opposite of pedal steel, where stylistically, while it's there for you, a certain tunings, like the C6 tuning, it has that Hawaiian sound. But if you don't want that Hawaiian sound, you're fucked. You have to know what to do, because if you are casual about it, you will sound like you don't want to sound. So you have to be aware of a lot of things in a slightly different way than pedal steel. Pedal steel is like a machine that is doing country music sounds for you. The lap steel musically is more limitless. And so by playing, you know, unless you're playing Hawaiian music, and then, you know, it's there for you. It's great. If all you want to do is play Hawaiian music, it's amazing. But, you know, Jason afforded me that, and I played in this Emmylou band, you know, north of Amarillo, and we got to like play all these tunes that are amazing. And I was like, well, what am I waiting for? Am I waiting for someone to call me and say, hey, can you play three sets of like 50 tunes that you probably won't know that well, and you just won't do a good job as you would like to do? And I was like, no, I'm really happy in Syncane, and I'm really proud of it, and I want everything to be like that. So then, you know, my year is culminating in a concert of music that I had been working on for the last year and a half, and I had that to look forward to, and that I had been working on. And I said, well, I'm going to just do this, and I'm going to work as hard as I can in Syncane, because we're working on a new record, and I'm going to work on my music extremely hard, and I'm going to play with my friends, and I'm going to have a great time. I'm not like taking myself off the market, but I'm going to be a little bit more selective about the projects I choose and why I choose them. And then, of course, I get an email from Rich Hinman, who says, hello, recommended you for a gig. You're going to get a phone call today. And then that gig was with a major touring artist, and with, you know, it was like a 3-minute conversation that said, hey, rehearsal start here. And that was the week of my concert. And this is all happening within a 1-week time frame of me, you know, losing my gig to a pedal steel player who will do it for free.
For free. Yeah. You know what though?
My own identity.
You know what? In that case, just to cut before you get to the other thing.
Yeah.
You know what I do in business? I have this thing called the asshole tax.
Yep.
I'm serious. And when you get someone like that, you get the fucking asshole tax. So if I charge X, I now charge 1.5X or 2X, because that guy's an asshole. And
it's just the triangle of like, what does this mean to you? So is it good music? Are there good friends? Is the money good?
Right.
And that it has to be 180 degrees, you know, like, and you can choose what boundaries you want, you know? And so I talk with the manager, and they're like, it's like a 12-18 month commitment. And this is literally the dream of mine from when I first started playing pedal steel. You know, things change. And the first rehearsal started the week of my concert, of my music for the first, you know, I've never done that before, written music and performed a concert. That's all my music, you know. And I just said, well, that's like literally the only non-movable date of the entire year, you know. And that was the end of the conversation.
Wow.
You know, I could have got to play the Beacon and all these great places, and it probably would have been a lot of fun. But at the end of the day, you know, I'm going to finish this year, and I'm going to have made 3 records that I'm really proud of, and I will have put a lot of energy into them. And that is valuable to me right now.
Yeah.
You know,
good for you, man. And it doesn't mean that opportunity won't come around again, or another similar opportunity.
Things are good for me now with Syncane and with this group of people, and you know, I can't be more proud of that stuff that, you know, that I'm doing, and I'm really lucky. And to be honest, like, my older brother has done very well for himself, and he recently sold his company, and he believes in art, and I'm not like, he doesn't just sit and give me resources, but his support of just saying, you have to just keep doing what you're doing, because that's important.
That's great. You know,
it's not about This is a luxurious statement and a privileged statement, you know, but because I'm there, it means that I have an even greater responsibility to honor myself and what I do musically. So he says, whatever, you know, if you ever need help, I have like a huge trampoline or what a safety net, not a trampoline. I don't know why that came. I watched too many internet videos of kids falling off trampolines, you know, and so I want to honor that and I want to honor myself, you know, and I think that's really important.
And man, you know what? Sometimes life just happens. It wouldn't have been any different if you were having a baby that week. It just happened to be, it wasn't a baby. It was a musical baby.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
and so that's it. End of conversation, man. Life happens, man. And this is the whole, you know, throughout your whole life, you get opportunities and you question them. Should I do them? Should I not do them? This is a constant ongoing thing. And this time it wasn't fit, man. So, where are you originally from?
I was born in New York and raised in Northern New Jersey. I'm still bitter at my parents for selling their limestone building on 106 in Riverside.
Oh my God.
Well, you know, in the 70s.
Oh yeah. 106 in Riverside was a little dodgy.
They got broken into too many times with my older brother and they left for the suburbs, you know, but yeah, I always envision myself in New York City, as a reality, not even as a dream. Just like when I grow up, you just move to New York.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until I was an adult and I first moved to Brooklyn and I had been living uptown, like way uptown, like, you know, basically the Bronx. I live by the University Ave Bridge. I live like 186 and Laurel Terrace, which is like the last street. Like I was looking on the East River, you know, it's like, is that Lexington up there or Lafayette, Lexington? You know, like right by Yeshiva University. I could like see the University Avenue Bridge. And I moved to Brooklyn and after a decision of wanting to live by my friends rather than live by my work, because I still taught a lot of guitar lessons in New Jersey. And so, you know, 186 was a great in between, but just doing anything was a little bit difficult to get downtown. And I moved to Brooklyn and I was like, distinctly remember this feeling of going, I'm home. And one of my best friends and oldest friends, I've known him. Our parents have known each other. I've known him for literally my entire life. Our parents were friends in the, you know, 70s. They lived in Carroll Gardens.
Queens.
Know, in Brooklyn.
Okay.
Like by Red Hook,
I know nothing about Brooklyn. Like when I grew up was just like,
you don't go there.
No, it was the same misery as the Bronx, except on the other side of the D-train. I'm like, I got all this mess fucking here. Why do I need to go travel an hour and 15 minutes on the D-train to go see the same shit over there?
Yeah. Yeah. So like, I just was like, I'm home. Like the feeling that I had was
that's cool, man.
And then, you know, getting a little bit older, that was in my 20s and realizing that, my older brother and my younger brother, three boys, God bless my mother, and they never really wanted to be here. My older brother went to school in Boston and then moved to California, and my younger brother went to school in New Jersey at Rutgers, and then he just moved to California, you know, and now he's back. But it was always just like a dream of mine, or like it wasn't even a dream. It just was like what I was going to do. I was destined to be here. You know, my mom grew up here, you know, and my grandparents were here and my great grandparents were here, you know? So it was like just following the, you know, it's fun to like drive around the Lower East Side with my mom, who would be like, oh yeah, that's like where I got mugged. You know, my mom came to school in the Lower East Side.
That has changed so much, that area. Oh,
I remember that library, you know, and yeah, that neighborhood has really changed a lot. So,
well, it's funny, like in the 70s and 60s, the Bowery was like Skid Row.
It was still Skid Row even 10 years ago. There's still spots that are like Skid Row now, you know?
It's amazing, man. And now all these shishi places down there boggles my mind every time it's there.
It's a lot. New York City is a lot right now.
Oh, it's crazy.
You know, like everywhere, like, you know.
So what was your childhood like growing up? Sounds pretty normal, pretty healthy.
Yeah, I just, you know, played sports, took piano lessons, you know. I grew up in a small town next to Hackensack, like, you know, not a very diverse town. But very close. Like, I could get into the New York, I can get into Port Authority, which was terrifying.
Yeah, back in the day. Holy shit, yeah.
And it's still a terrifying place to me. It's still the most terrifying place to me in New York.
Really? Port Authority?
There's just like so much people in transit. There's like homeless people everywhere. And it just is like embodies my childhood, like, personal space sensory alarm. And it still does.
Really? Yeah. It's cleaned up a lot, man.
It's cleaned up so much. But just like everyone around, like, in, you know, it's like the montage of like the kid like entering a family, you know, from the kid's point of view, like entering a family thing, and like aunties are squeezing his cheeks and like, how's it going?
Yeah, you know, yeah.
Telling the same jokes for 10 years. Like, that's what it feels like when I go to the Port Authority. People handing out samples and like a million people going somewhere in a rush. And
yeah, that's funny, man. The only time I get like that on high alert is like if I'm with, I mean, I'm always sort of on high alert, but like, I remember one time we were in the city and my daughter, it was her birthday and she wanted to go to see the Cake Boss in Jersey. So we had to go to the Port Authority and take a freaking bus. So just
like Union City, right? Or Weehawken?
It's like 20 minutes. It was, I can't remember the name of the town, but it was freaking in December. It was ice cold and you get to the fucking Cake Boss and the only reason you know is because four blocks away it's the line. And I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. What are you going to do here? And it's a bakery. I mean, there's like 100 bakeries we just left that have really good shit and you don't have to wait. So we just sat there freezing and to get a picture of her with the Cake Boss's sister, I think, or something like that. But, you know, she's a little girl, but whatever that was. But then I was on high alert because I got my wife and my daughter. My wife is from a small, small town in the UK. Like, I don't think she saw anybody that wasn't like white Anglo-Saxon Protestant probably until she was like in high school. And my daughter, who's like 70 pounds soaking wet at that time. So I'm on like, you know. What kind of jobs did your folks do?
My mom was a fashion designer.
Wow, that's awesome.
My dad was an electrical engineer. He worked for Hewlett Packard.
So did you get your like creative flair from your mom?
I'm really, really, really lucky. And my parents always encouraged me to do whatever I wanted to do. They and all of my brothers are in creative. My older brother is a writer, journalist, and then my younger brother is a furniture maker, and he also builds. He went to school to design sets. He loves art.
That's great. And
it's from our parents. We all went to Montessori school.
Man, that is
which I know a lot of people that did, and it doesn't necessarily prepare you for real life, but it prepares you for it. It's like the way that I'm really lucky. I learned how to learn very young. I learned how I learned. I never could deal with public school. Like the first day at class in second grade in Mrs. Young's class, she said spelling test. And man, for people who don't know, Montessori school is a type of learning started by a woman from Italy, I think. And you basically are taught the tools to learn. And I remember just sitting there. No one tells you what to do. You just go to this thing. And I remember sitting and completing math notebooks by myself because it was fun, you know? And I went to public school and I sat down in Mrs. Young's class, who I found out much later was Jehovah's Witness, but I never knew that. Like all these things that just like go over your head. Yeah. I don't know why that even matters. It doesn't.
Did she knock on your door in the evening?
No, but someone said to me later in life, "Do you remember Mrs. Young was Jehovah's Witness?" And I was like, No, and yeah, she would leave the room when people would celebrate their birthday, and she wasn't there for holidays, you know?
Interesting.
Anyway, she was a nice teacher, but so the spelling test, the first word, she goes train, and I just raised my hand, and I just said T-R-A-I-N, you know? I remember this, and then the whole class burst out laughing, and I was like, what the fuck are we doing? What the fuck is this? <You know?
laughs> Oh my God, that's hilarious, man.
But fast forward to like, I took guitar lessons from Vic Juris, who's a New York
City. Oh my God, what a great player. He's a monster, yeah.
He is an unbelievable monster, and I was really, really lucky to have a couple really great teachers. And part of his thing was that I would show up and he would be like, I remember working on Autumn Leaves with him, and I listened to like blues guitar players growing up. You know, I love the blues. I love B.B. King. I love Freddie King. And I love the Three Kings. And I listened to tons of Stevie Ray Vaughan and Eric Clapton. And I loved that stuff. So I remember two things with him was I would show up and he would go write a chorus. And so I would show up 2 weeks later and I will have written a solo out. And that's still basically how I practice. I like write things out, like work on rhythm changes. You know, this is part of how all this music got written last year, is that I would be on tour and I would wake up 2 hours before van call and I would sit and I would write out, I would try to write 8 bars every day of something, you know, just any working on specific things or working on anything, you know. And so it would take like a couple days to like write a whole chorus, and then I would learn it and then, you know, move on to the next. It was not really about memorizing it. It was kind of about being in touch with my musical ear and my musical brain. And so this is brings me back to like how I learned in Montessori. That was kind of at my own pace, but like a distillation of what I wanted to express. And there's things that I write that just don't come into my playing, you know, but that's fine. That's not what there it's kind of about. It's just kind of like about tickling my own ear, and through awakening my inner ear more, that it really helped me in the writing process.
I have had a bunch of buddies over the years who sent their kids to Montessori, and all of them are super creative.
Yeah.
It's a really good school for that, to develop your creativity, man. If you could have gone back, Johnny, and like given yourself advice, or given younger Johnny Lamb advice, what advice would you have heard that would have made your life easier in some way, either professionally or personally?
I don't know. I my life is kind of like every day I feel like is the best day.
That's awesome. You know? That's great.
It's not like a blindness, but I always feel, you know, I feel always working towards something. And there are so many things now that are coming to realization in my brain that I learned 20 years ago. And I don't know if anything I could have said to myself younger other than you're different. You know, like you find your own path, but it wouldn't have meant anything to me, you know?
Sure.
So more than going back and saying I don't know if this is dodging the question, but it feels like, I don't know if younger self would have been able to absorb any information, you know, but I do sometimes say, I wish I could just go back in time and beat the shit out of like my 12-year-old self and just be like, you know, just go crazy. Enjoy life. You're young. Have a great time. Other than like the cliche shit, you know, stop worrying so much, you know?
Yeah.
Go to the doctor. Migraines every day after school and throwing up for 2 years of your life is not normal.
Yeah, man. Well, I'm glad you're not still doing that. Let's talk about gear for a few minutes. I know nothing about pedal steel at all. So if we can keep it to like electric, although I will ask you one pedal steel question because I got a lot of listeners.
We can do another 2 hours here. Let's go.
What's your go-to guitar right now? And what other two guitars of yours would round out your top three? Not for sessions. I mean, the guitars you go to grab that you like.
Okay. I have a lot of guitars. I have a reasonable amount of guitars. I view guitars as tools.
Yeah.
Like, I don't own two Strats. I own a Strat, you know, like, because a Strat does a certain thing. I believe that there are special guitars, but I think inherent in the design of guitars, they inspire you differently. So I like having lots of different guitars. That being said, I recently, within the last like 3 years, acquired a 1950 Epiphone Emperor Regent,
what is that?
It's like Epiphone's highest model guitar to compete with the Super 400. It's like the Gibson Super 400, which is like an 18 inch bout. It's like an 18 and a half inch bout guitar with a super deep cutaway, like a 19 fret cutaway. That was like Epiphone's top of the line guitar. And it was always, there's just something always about Epiphone guitars I've been drawn to. And this was a guitar that I never, ever, ever, ever thought I would own. But I found it on Craigslist in New Jersey. And it had been there for a while. And the pictures were pretty bad.
I'm going to look it up while you're talking because I want to see what this thing looks like. Sorry, go ahead.
And I met him at a guitar center early in the morning. And I was the only one in the parking lot. Excuse me. And I see this old Toyota Camry roll up, like the square ones from the 80s. Like the 80s, a small one.
The small one. Yeah. This is a nice guitar, man. This is like an old jazz box.
Yeah, it's an great arch top. It's the king of arch tops for me. And I was like, oh, that's the guy. And I was like, this guitar is worth more than that car, you know? So I go over there and we talk and I end up buying it from him. And the guitar is a fucking basket case, you know. It had been owned by his childhood friend's father, who was a country music singer in New Jersey. His name was Fred Hughes. And it had gotten the shit played out of it. There's like overspray, got like spray painted black, kind of. Like someone tried to like refinish it. It was a pretty fucked up guitar that was coming apart. The top was off, and I brought it to my repair guy, who's my favorite repair guy of all time, and he's gonna leave in like a year or two to move down to North Carolina to be with his daughter, which I get, but I'm pissed. He refrets all my guitars, and I can't, you know. Alan Watsky, New Jersey, that guy fucking rules. Just someone who cares and is technical and is neurotic and also plays. And I think it's like the perfect balance for a repair guy, because sometimes I've had experience with repair people in New York where the overhead is really difficult, where they don't want to work on things that they don't like, or they don't do a good job on the things that they don't think are special. And I don't have time for that or money to waste on that.
Yeah. Cause it's all special to you if you're bringing in a guitar, man. Yeah.
Well, the thing that I learned from Alan is started refretting guitars for me is like what the way that, you know, just the way that he does it, I'm just really into. So anyway, Alan had to basically totally disassemble this guitar. The neck was coming off, needed to be re-glued. He had to rebind some of the stuff. The back was totally off. I've seen the inside of my guitar. I've like held the top of my guitar, you know, it's incredible. Like
it's a big, thick guitar, isn't it?
I mean, yeah, it's like, 3 inches. It's like an arch top, you know, but like holding the top that someone had carved, you know, is incredible. That guitar, and I have a lap steel guitar by Todd Klein Smith, which is cast aluminum. That lap steel, and not because it's a lap steel, but because I just think it's one of my favorite instruments. Like, you know, I guess I gauge my instruments on how much they inspire me. And then I have a Melody Maker, like a 61 Melody Maker that I got off eBay many years ago as a basket case. And I had someone put a P90 in it and put a different bridge on it, and they actually did a really shitty job. And that was the first guitar I had brought to Alan, and he refretted it, and he totally transformed the guitar, and it's just like this little monster, and I really like it.
What is that? Is that like a sound like an old Gibson? What does that sound like?
An old Gibson Melody Maker.
Yeah.
You know.
Very cool, man. Name a couple of players that you've really, if you've played, I don't know if you've played a lot of other guitars, but it sounds like you have because you're through the pedal steel. Name a couple of guitars you've really enjoyed jamming with, and then is there other couple that you'd like to jam with?
The guitar players who all played on my record are all, I asked them because they were all really special to me. Like Luca, he was, Honeyfinger started as like, I played pedal steel and we were just like trying to play 2 45-minute sets. And that's hard to do instrumentally. Mm-hmm. The gig didn't pay very much. And I would do it trio with a bass player, you know, without a drummer is really difficult. And Luca was the guitar player and we played so much music together. You know, there was a point where we would be playing and I'm playing pedal steel and he's playing guitar and we play the exact same thing.
Holy shit. That's pretty cool.
And we would look at each other and just go same, you know, like it happened a lot, you know? And
so you guys just had a very good vibe.
I think he's so great. Then Jason Laughlin, who played on the Exotica record as well. I mean, I just like respect him so much as like this, as a band leader and like his vision and the way that he chases his visions. I think he's such a, he like can focus in on like these minute details of things and really incorporate them into his playing. And I'm always, will be always grateful to him for the amount that we got to play and like, as like Western swing kids basically, and like grow up together, you know, playing that kind of stuff, which was his music, you know, a lot of his music and arrangements that he would bring in. And, you know, I got to meet Tim Lunsell through him, who's still, you know, I said before, but is like, was such a special person in my life. Mm. And Andy Borger, who's an incredible drummer. So Jason and Nate Radley, who played on the record also, who's an inspiration, just like he's such an amazing guitar player. And we have such great talks about what music means to us and this like weird journey of his own personal journey of like jazz guitar, which is really difficult. And, you know, sonically, what is jazz guitar? That's like a really, really hard question, you know, because what are you going to do? Like turn your, all the sounds that I've been spoken for.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like a not a very sonically diverse thing. And when I made the record earlier this year, the one of the hardest conversations was what guitar sound is going to identify this. And I had to avoid like beautiful guitar sound because then you get into Frizzell territory. You had to avoid muted, clean guitar sound because then you're just in straight up cliche jazz guitar territory. You know, like it's such an identity sonically that it was a hard thing. And so it's great to talk with Nate about those kind of things. And, you know, Rich Hinman, who was like my idol, he was the first guy in New York that doubled on that I knew that was like a great pedal steel player and a great guitar player. And he sounds like himself on both. Like when I hear him play guitar, I can recognize him. And he plays those same things on pedal steel and he's incredible. And, you know, yeah, I guess. Those are the guitar players that I off the top of my head right now that I like, I really respect and love. And I guess, of course, it was like a huge honor for Jim to ask Honeyfingers to like back him up. Mm. You know, this is such a cool thing. And Jim is so incredible because he has mindlessly and mindfully forged his own personal identity.
Yeah.
on guitar, which is really, really, really difficult. You know, and in terms of guitar players, I'd love to play with. I would love to play with Bill Frisell, I think, and Greg Lease. You know, those guys are the. Greg was the one of the first times I had heard pedal steel. I didn't even know what it was, and it was on a Bill Frisell record. It took me a really long time, even playing, to go, oh shit, that was pedal steel, you know. And then I went back to revisit it, and I was like, oh yeah, it is, you know. And that was kind of a cool thing. And I just like love Frisell's sense of melody and his uniqueness. And I would love to play with Mark Rebo. You know, I love guitar players, so I would love to play with all of them.
I love guitar players. That's cool, man. I like that.
I love guitar. That's why I play it.
Yeah, everyone loves guitar.
Yeah, everyone loves guitar. Although sometimes I really fucking hate steel guitar. It really pisses me off. Guitar, I'm currently in a love affair with guitar, not steel guitar, but it's only one or the other. I can't love both.
That's so. All right, man. Hey, Desert Island Discs, top three. No particular order, knowing this could change tomorrow, just for now, this minute.
Oh, man, let me think. Kind of Blue, Miles Davis, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Hank Mobley, Soul Station, and Grant Green, Sonny Clark Quartets.
Interesting. Man, I don't know why I don't hear Grant. No,
you set that question up in a nice way that's like, it can change any time. And so that's, I just like tried to think of records that I loved and where I am right now.
Yeah, because
and I don't think I've listened to either one of those records, any of those records in so long. You know, I'm listening to like tons of Mahavishnu and Joni Mitchell now, but like those records are ones that I tried to just think about what records give me a good feeling and I can remember the whole record.
Yeah.
And those three records for sure.
I'm surprised I don't hear more Grant Green.
It's an animal. It's the best.
Tough question, man. What do you like most about yourself, Johnny?
Oh,
do you know Adam? I had the best answer for this. Do you know who Adam Zimmern is?
I don't know.
Adam is in L.A. He plays with Ziggy Marley. Very hilarious. I mean, fucking hilarious guy. I asked him this question. He goes, how can I answer that question when I have so much self-loathing? That was classic.
True. The
funniest answer that I've ever heard. Like such as an artist answer, you know, particularly a musician.
Huh. God. I don't know, man. I don't know.
Come on, you got to come up with an answer for that one.
I think that I have a positive energy, and I like to think that I can bring that to people and they can understand that. I'm always very encouraging, and you know, I think that's a,
you answered it. That's good.
Yeah.
Pass. If you didn't become a professional musician,
fuck you.
If you didn't become a professional musician, what do you think you would have done instead?
I don't know. When I was a kid, the last time I had dreams about doing anything else other than music was when I was in Mrs. Young's class in second grade, and I talked with my friend Lee Hu, and the things that we dreamed about was I was either going to become a fireman, an astronaut, or a lawyer, and I'm not really sure. And then I never really thought about jobs or anything. And then I just ended up at music school. And
where'd you go to music school?
I went to a college in New Jersey called William Patterson.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Do you know Jimmy Leahy?
Who?
Jimmy Leahy.
Oh, yeah, I know. Did he go there?
He worked there, actually. While he was like the handyman there.
Shut up.
I swear. Yeah. And you know what? I'll tell you who went. This is really funny. I interviewed Jimmy and then the next, and then I, you know, Scott Metzger.
Yes, of course.
Scott went there. Yeah. But I interviewed Jimmy and then like in the morning and then in the afternoon, I interviewed Scott. And Jimmy worked there as like basically a handyman for like 10 or 12 or 15 years while he was doing music.
Well, Scott was there?
I don't know if it was the same time when Scott's there. Scott, I think, is a little younger. Jimmy's like my age, and Scott's probably 10 or so years younger than both of us.
Yeah, Scott was there just finishing when I was there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Another great guitar player who was there, Jim Oblong.
Oh, Jim went there? I didn't know that. Let me tell you, man, that guy is an amazing guitar player. He was
Have you done an interview with him?
I interviewed Jim, and then he was down here about a month ago, and he had a night off, so we went out and we hung out, and that was like, I actually went out drinking. I haven't done that in years. We had a really relaxing night, drinking and smoking cigars.
Oh, that sounds great.
This is a fun question, man. What's your favorite New York City food?
I love food as much as I love guitar, maybe more. New York has some, in general, the food that I love most in New York is like the cheap, authentic food, like pizza.
Oh, yeah.
Or like dumplings or noodles. I've been craving this place in New York, in Flushing, that does like a hand-pulled noodle soup with lamb. That's great. The place is called Lamb Noodle Soup. Incredible name.
Yeah, I love the pizza, man.
Pizza, man. Like DeFara's pizza is sublime. Like I've been fortunate enough to have some really fantastic meals, and the thing that happens, like when 1 + 1 = 3, you know, like wine and cheese or like a great combination. And there's just something special about DeFara's pizza that's unique and perfect. You know, I don't know what happened. I need to like write these questions down because I get so lost in my own brain and then I don't remember I don't even remember what the question was.
No, you answered it. It was favorite New York City food. Yeah. You did it, man.
DeFara's pizza.
Yeah, man. Who's had the biggest influence on your life, both musically and personally?
I think Vic Juris in terms of like his effect on my life is still palpable. Just in the way he was the perfect teacher for me. He was always really respectful. I really believe in like the tree of teaching, because I taught a lot of lessons. The tree of like mentorship, where you treat your teachers with a lot of respect as, you know, as if they are in control of your future, which in a lot of ways they are. And that a lot of times will elicit a respect back. Not in terms of kindness or whatever, not like, oh, them being nice to you, but them respecting what you're doing. And so, and that teaches you what it means to be a mentor to someone, you know, like getting lost in these books and learning from videos and not learning from a human is good because you have access to a lot of information. But how do you use that information, I guess? And, you know, and you don't learn how to teach others from watching videos, which is part of it, you know?
Where'd you get that attitude from about honoring the mentorship relationship?
I think like growing up as a Chinese person, you recognize like a large nuclear family and you have like 1,000 aunties and uncles. Hmm. And I wasn't always respected, but like respectful to my aunties and uncles because I'm, you know, I was an asshole kid, as we all are, you know, have been. But those kind of thoughts are ingrained in your brain. And as you get older and you start to feel more respect, and you need those people in your life. You know, this is not an island. Like, you don't make music by yourself. You make music with other people.
I thought that I was – go I'm sorry. Go on. No, I apologize. Go ahead.
I just think it's like such an important attitude, and it's like that submissive attitude, because like as a musician, as a sideman, you serve the leader, you serve his vision, but they ask you hopefully so you can put your vision on their vision.
Yeah.
Double vision. And as a band leader, you choose your musicians either, you know, hopefully based on their service to you, but you're also in service to them. You know, it's like goes both ways always. And you can get lost in yourself and forget that other people are there and you have to take care of them. You know, it's like Jerry Garcia was like, I want to stop doing this. And someone was like, you're responsible for a lot of people's livelihood. And he knew that it was important for him to keep going, and it killed him. But it doesn't have to be that extreme.
Sure.
But you are responsible for other people. And I think that it's, you know, like it's easy to get lost in like, oh my God, I'm like losing my shirt on this. But, you know, but those people are giving you something special. And that's hopefully that's why you've chosen them. So like, oh, like I want, I on my record, I have John Coward, amazing piano player, who's like one of my great friends. And I wanted him. I didn't want another piano player. Like I wanted what John had to offer me. And I had Andy Borger play, and I wanted Andy to contribute what Andy wanted. And I wrote music around it, you know, and hopefully they responded. And I felt like they responded to that honor that I gave them. And they honored me by working hard and giving themselves to the music.
Did
I answer the question?
Or you did. No. You totally did. I thought that was an Asian kind of mindset or philosophy or viewpoint. And I wish I had learned stuff like that. There's a lot of wisdom in a lot of the like the basic tenets of like Asian behavior that, you know, I don't, there's a lot of, man, it would be so easier if there was like a, like that, you know, if school, that's the kind of shit that we need to learn in school, you know, not like, you know, who bombed, you know, this country at this particular time, or, you know, conjugating a verb, and maybe it's very idealistic and simplistic, but I think that stuff like that benefits you so like, you know, deeply and long-term, and, you know, communication wise, just, you know, just relationship wise, I don't know.
I mean, everything, if we think about even modern politics, it's like, where is the respect anymore?
Oh, you
know,
zero.
Like Anton Scalia and Ruth Bader Ginsburg were really good friends. You know, like that can't happen. That doesn't happen anymore.
No.
Because people are so.
Yeah. It's about me.
Animalistic about their opinion.
It's very self-centered, man. How about personally, who's the biggest influence on you? So Vic musically, or was Vic personally too?
I think that my girlfriend and I've been together for about 5 years, and she's been very important to me, teaching me about kindness and, you know, opening my mind.
That's very nice, man.
Because like you go on tour and you come back and you're like a mess, and you know, it's just, and she's not been there. She's been there in support of me, but in a way where I can like figure out what is, you know, like realizing that like I'm anxious and I'm all these things and just like being away.
That's awesome, man. That's great. I'm happy for you, man. Three more questions, and I appreciate your time. Any hobbies or interests outside of music?
I surf. I play sports, but currently I'm I surf, you know.
In Brooklyn?
In Queens or Long Island.
Do you really? This surf? Yeah, right. My buddy used to surf out
there. It's a fucking island. It's like there's like 200 miles of coast.
I know. You don't usually think of Brooklyn as the mecca of, you know, surfing comes to mind. But yeah, my buddy.
I would hardly call it a surfing mecca, but there's surf and you can do it.
Favorite place you've traveled?
I've been really fortunate to have been pretty well traveled. Last year we got to go on tour to New Zealand, and that was pretty incredible. We went to a place called Taranaki, which is in the southwest corner of the North Island. It's like a, there's great surf there, but we got to play festival there, and that was wonderful. I love, yeah, I think.
You're pretty well balanced. Seem really well balanced. Like, your attitude is, you're not like obsessive, unhealthy work.
I'm a fucking guitar player with like a gazillion guitars and amps. Of course I'm obsessive.
No, but you're like, but you take time for like doing stuff, and it seems like you're able to smell the roses a little bit.
These are all from being on tour, you know? So, and you know, I like to always say that I seem very calm, but the tempest is inside.
Yeah. It's very Asian. You know that. I'm expecting to hear some like the, you know, some, I need a deep quote here to fill this in to complete it. You know,
I don't
like
have anything deep.
Some, last question, man. And,
but I also love, you know, like the food in Japan is so wonderful and it's so easy. South of France, like, I don't know. Well, I love a lot of places, but I was maybe thinking of moving somewhere to some other places. And what I came to realize in all the other places and in this place is that these cities are wonderful and these places are wonderful, but the thing that's really wonderful about them are the people that I know and I love. And that is what makes places for me.
Yeah.
You know, all these great, in my mind, when I'm thinking about all these places, I love the South of France because I have two really wonderful friends that live in the Basque country in France. And I visited them and I love them. And I love Nashville because my friend Jamie Lydell is there and his wife, Lindsay, who's amazing. And their son, Julian, who's incredible. He's amazing. They showed me this party trick. I just was there. Where he's almost three and they can put on records that he's familiar with. And within 1 second, he can tell you what track number it is. And nice. It's fucked up. It's so fast.
Name that tune for Baby Geniuses.
And he just holds up his fingers. It takes him longer to choose like the cutout number on the floor than for him to recognize. It's pretty awesome.
That's cool.
But like people, you know, like the people are what's important.
Sure.
Yeah.
Totally, man. Last question, and I cannot thank you enough for your time. This has been really cool.
So fun.
Anything you do to make sure you're getting the most out of your life and enjoying your time as much as possible?
I'm a pretty messy person, and I can be really cluttered in my mind. And one of the great lessons I learned from Jim Campolongo is to be organized. And I'm not organized. But I try to like respect time and like what it takes to do things and to be not hard on myself.
That's great. That's like really important.
But I'm very hard on myself. I am very, you know,
yeah.
This year was, I came back, I went to Sudan last December and I ended up getting sick. Came back and the travel is so crazy and, you know, it's like 35 hours travel.
Holy shit.
And came back and it was Christmas and I was like, okay, I'm like done with tour for the year. And I'm going to January, February, I'm going to finish all this music. And I was sick for 2 months, you know, not from Sudan, but I like got food poisoning in Sudan and I came back and I was still sick. And then I got a cold and it took me 2 weeks of fighting that. And being ashamed of myself that I wasn't working hard enough.
Oh my God.
To just go, hey man, like you're sick. Like just sleep and just relax. You don't have to practice. You don't have to write. Just like relax, you know? And that was part of this year. This year has been pretty great for me in terms of like mentally just coming into a good place, you know, and being okay with who I am and where I am, but not complacent. Just being like, well, today is today and tomorrow is going to be tomorrow.
Yeah. Age will fix some of that. As you get a little older, like you become like, I'm super demanding of myself, but I'm much more forgiving of myself.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like the standard is always high, but like I'm more reasonable with me. Like it's funny you mentioned that because like my daughter was sick and I got sick I never fucking get sick. I take really good care of myself and I had the flu about, I don't know, 18 months ago. I literally, I don't think I've done this in my adult life. I slept all day for like 7 days straight and I was totally good with it. And in the past I would have been like
freaking out.
How can you do this?
I got to do this. You know, oh, it's so stressful.
I was so good with it. I was like, and I was really happy that I was so good with it because it was like, you know, I was like just taking care of myself, you know, really when it comes down to it. And I was just glad I was able to do that. It's tough. It took me a long time to get there. So, man, I can't thank you enough. Let me tell people where to find you. You're an awesome dude. I hope when I come to the city that you'll be playing somewhere. Please check out Johnny Lamb. It's Johnny, J-O-N-N-Y, Lamb. And mostly you could find him involved with Sin Cane. And Sin Cane is S-I-N-K-A-N-E. He is also on Instagram at Johnny Parties, J-O-N-N-Y-P-A-R-T-Y-S. Although you're not a party guy, are you?
I'm pretty mellow now.
Yeah. but Johnny Parties, and when Johnny comes out with new stuff, he'll come back on the show and we'll roll it out here. We'll have a big launch on Everyone Loves Guitar for Johnny's stuff because it's good. And thank you, man. Any final words of wisdom?
You guys, anyone, you can do whatever the fuck you want. Have a great fucking time and just have the best time. That, just fuck it. Just do it.
That may be the fucking smartest thing I've heard anybody say on this show. Thank you, man. That is great.
Who the fuck cares? Just have the
best just time. Have a good time. Nobody, it just doesn't fucking matter right now. Hey, man.
But also, ultimately, everything matters. So, you know, you got to be.
There's the Asian shit. He threw that twist in there at the end. Dude, thank you so much for everything, man. I really appreciate it. This has been great. Thanks for being so cool and being transparent and sharing your story, man. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Craig.
Everybody, thanks so much for listening. If you enjoyed this interview, please share it on with a friend on your social media channels. We certainly appreciate your support. Please support Johnny Lamb and his music and check him out online. Check out Sin Cane. And like I said, he's going to be coming out with some new stuff and hopefully we'll get to hear it here first or talk about it here first. Make sure you go to the homepage of everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get on our newsletter list. We'll give you advanced notice of guests coming in and you can ask them your own questions. And most important, remember that happiness is a choice. So choose wisely. Be nice, go play your guitar, and have fun. Till next time, thanks for listening. Peace and love. I'm out. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.